You are listening to a dramatic monologue by Jenna Veenbass, recorded on Sunday, February 3, 2013, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Part of me wanted to just sit here and wait until the silence became uncomfortable. The point wouldn't have been to make you uncomfortable, but rather to give you the experience of absolute silence. Because it is often in that silence when we become very aware of ourselves, what we're thinking, how we're feeling. And yes, this can be uncomfortable. So the instant reaction is to want to talk to someone else, a neighbor who is sharing the same experience. It's refreshing. Their company quenches your thirst for empathy because they know what you're going through. But what happens when you don't have anyone beside you, when you're alone? No one to talk to, no one to hear you. You're in the silence, as if you're in a drought, waiting for something to quench your thirst for understanding. Then the question becomes, do you stay in the place where it is dry? Or do you go out and search for water? For years, I stayed in the desert, waiting alone for a rain that would never come. There were people around, but their voices were a dry wind blowing past me. I lived in a constant silence. There were moments when I thought it could be broken, when I thought I could share something worthwhile, I could be useful. But like any household object, my worth was defined by my usefulness. Take this water jar, for instance. It is a useful tool so long as it can fulfill its purpose and the space inside is able to be filled. But if not, then it just sits in a corner and fills a space. For years, I filled a space. And really, for a woman of Samaria, this isn't unusual. The real problem was that the space in me was never being filled. So here's the story. Yes, I'm a Samaritan, and we from Samaria have our own special reputation here in this nation of Palestine. We are a people of both Jewish and foreign backgrounds, so in the eyes of the pure Jews in Judea, we are at best half-breeds. See, centuries ago, in the time of the Assyrians, the king of Assyria brought people from all over the empire to what was then Israel, and placed them in the region of Samaria to intermarry with the Jews who lived there. Well, these foreigners started to lead the Jewish people astray in the ways of their cultures, and terrible things started to happen. Lions came and devoured many of the people, and the king of Assyria realized that the Israelite God was obviously opposed to this mixing of religions. So he sent a Jewish priest to teach the new inhabitants this God's laws. But those in Judea still looked down on Samaria for its association with pagans, its altering of the Holy Scriptures, and eventually the building of its own temple up on Mount Gerizim, near Jacob's Well. So there's always been tension between these two areas, so much so that men traveling from Judea up to Galilee will actually take an extra day's journey to go across and along the Jordan and then back over again, just to avoid our defiled region. If you're wondering how I came to attain this knowledge, I understand. It's not very common. I was able to learn this in secret from my mother, who was able to benefit in the same way from her mother. She would tell me stories every night when I was a child, in the years when I hadn't yet experienced what I usually call the great silence. And I would often fall asleep listening to her voice. She would teach me about our Jewish fathers, The 12 tribes, the division, the exile. I was enthralled by these stories, and her eyes would light up every time she spoke of this god, Yahweh, and that he was different from all of the other gods. This god, she said, protected orphans and widows, gave his people homes to live in, and led prisoners to prosperity. And then she'd speak of a hope that was yet to come, a redemption that we were a part of, a prophet greater than Moses. But many of my questions were left unanswered when I was taken away, and my curiosity was left behind, hanging. See, at 14, I was given to a husband and had to move to the village of Sychar, which is on the opposite end of Samaria. Here, my role was to refrain from asking questions, since in this household, a quiet woman was a tolerable woman, and knowledge was of no use to the duties of the home, which my husband was never slow to remind me of. But after a few years, he grew ill, and within a week he had passed on, so his younger brother then took possession over me and the house, which was against his will, considering the misfortune that his brother had just experienced, but the law instructed that he do so. So we were wed, and within a year's time he too had passed on from a similar illness to his brother's, and the family attributed it to be my fault. Since I hadn't been able to bear either of the men any children, my infertility was obviously a curse on the household, and the third brother was even more bitter than the former to now be stuck with me. If I couldn't bear a son, I was even more useless than one of the slave girls who probably could. So, by this point, I was accustomed to being ignored and holding no higher value than the goat in the back. If I was addressed, it was to scold me or remind me of my uselessness. And after a few months, it was already apparent that this husband was engaging himself with other women and being encouraged to do so. After about a year of being in this arrangement, I actually became pregnant, but when the child was born still and without life, the man decided it was about time to just divorce me before he shared the same fate. I was then married to a distant relative, but this arrangement was even shorter than all the others. He was a very pious man, and one evening at a gathering, when I spilled a glass of wine on the table, he assumed that I was drunk. And since a woman drunk is practically the equivalent of an adulteress, that was the end of that. You think this is absurd, don't you? 4 husbands in 6 years. But you don't understand. Without a husband, without a household, I am nothing. I serve this city by bearing children, sons who will further society, and if I can't do that, well, you can imagine the reputation that I'd already achieved. But then there was a small hope. A man who showed compassion and took me in, of a good household, married me, gave me another chance, a man of business and trade, owned a field and cattle, a good man. But also a man of misfortune. A man who, when traveling on the road to Galilee, was an easy target for robbers, who beat him and took more than just his money. A widow. Again, childless, abandoned, an empty vessel, and for what? It is here, at this point, that I find most difficult to explain. When the darkness came in, told me that it could fill my void, and persuaded me to do what my mind was believing to be the only option. I wanted to fight it. I did, but I had nothing to fight with. It pushed me outside to wander the streets in exile, cursing, screaming, my teeth grinding, my head pounding, my fists clenched, completely losing control and battling for days until I reached a point where suddenly the emotion was gone. I'd lost the battle and had become subject to the silence. I began living immorally, selling myself for a bed to sleep in. This sustained me for some time, as I was able to buy the occasional food item, and eventually even a water jar, although it wasn't much of one. The man who sold it to me invited me to come and live in his house, and by this point, I didn't have anything more to lose. The whole town would have expected as much. And although I heard conversations, I didn't say a word. Months went by, and I didn't speak with anyone. There was nothing to say. I didn't realize it at the time. But now looking back, I can see that my spirit had completely dried out. It had been left in the desert to shrivel, and my body was living proof of this. I wasn't eating. I barely left the house except to run errands, and only at times when I knew no one would be around to see me. Anything to avoid the stairs. Which is why I chose to get water every day when the sun was at its peak, because I knew that all the other women from town would have already gone or were waiting until evening. One midday, I picked up my water jar and slowly made my way out across the field in the direction of Mount Gerizim, to where the old temple once stood. Jacob's Well was along the way. It was the fifth month now, so the sun was extremely hot, and you could see the dry heat hazing over top of the dusty field. I had grown so weak over the past few months, I could barely put one foot in front of the other. Sweat poured down my face, and the drops made my eyes sting, forcing me to take multiple breaks along the way to wipe my forehead. But the more I stopped, the more parched I felt. My lips cracked. I began coughing. I heard crows above me circling the field. A snake hissed behind me. I became aware of the void. And I thought about the long rope that was waiting for me at the well. But just at that moment, the dust began to clear. And I looked up and realized that not only was I actually quite close to the well, but there was somebody there, sitting on it. I was, first of all, shocked to see someone there at this time of day. But then I grew irritated as I realized that it was a man, most likely a Jew, who must have been passing by and was stopping for a rest. As I drew closer, I could see the fatigue in his posture and the sweat stains on his garment. He must have come up from Jerusalem. The well was right alongside the main road, so I couldn't blame him for stopping, but of all the moments in the day to stop, this never happened. I was always so careful. It was almost worse than encountering another Samaritan. But perhaps he would see me coming and then just leave. But he didn't. When I approached the well, he looked up at me, and I stopped. And there was silence. Seeing no one else around, I wondered why he was there by himself, and from the look on his face, it was as if he was wondering the same thing about me. I decided to ignore his gaze and walked over to the opposite side of the well to set my jar on the edge, but I could feel his eyes following my movements as I began pulling up the water bucket. He didn't seem irritated by me or annoyed by the fact that he and I were alone at the well. I became curious as to who he was, but my mind immediately brushed that thought aside. I wouldn't find out anyways. There was no way he would speak to me. But then he did. And the shock of it almost made me spill all of the water that I had just pulled up. He spoke softly and said, "Give me a drink." And the absurdity of the situation made me want to look around and see if anyone else had approached to whom he was speaking, but it was just us. And as he stared at me, my next reaction was to simply obey and give him my water jar, but as I placed my hands on the sides of the vessel, I paused. This made no sense. He was a Jew. I was an unclean Samaritan, and a woman nonetheless. So for him to take a drink from my jar would be a ritual disaster. started to wonder if this was all just some cruel joke, and he was just going to throw my jar into the well. But even then, his hands would be infected from touching it. There was really nothing for me to lose at this point. So without looking at him, I spoke. I hadn't spoken in months, and my throat was so dry I could barely get the words out, but I asked him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria?" Seemingly ignoring my question, he then motioned for me to give him the jar, and as my shaking limbs passed it to him, a small amount of water spilled over the edge and fell onto his garment. I paused in horror, naturally expecting him to then retaliate for my clumsiness, but he didn't. In fact, the reaction he gave me was far from anger. He was laughing. He took the jar from me and with strong hands gripped the sides and put the spout to his mouth, taking huge gulps, so much that even more water spilled over the edge and ran down his chin. He splashed some of the water on his face, spread it around his neck, ran it through his hair. And as he set the jar back down, he breathed a sigh of satisfaction. And then he did something even more unexpected. He caught my gaze and looked me straight in the eyes. And then he responded, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." Now I was really confused. I looked down the well that was at least 100 feet deep, imagined the stagnant water sitting at the bottom, and wondered how this man could possibly obtain flowing water, and with nothing to hold it in. He wasn't carrying anything. He had no tools or belongings with him. Where would this water come from? And what more? Why would he give such a thing to me? So I said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water?" And as I said this, I looked down at the remaining water that sat idly in my jar and realized that I was incredibly thirsty. I wanted badly to take a drink, but the curiousness of this man's words actually made me more thirsty for answers. Remembering my mother's teachings, I asked him if he thought himself better than our father Jacob, who in fact gave us this well and drank from it himself. This source of refreshment was a sacred sight. How did this one man think that he could offer something greater? Well, he also then looked at the motionless water that sat in my jar and responded, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." Even now, I can still feel the intensity of the void in that moment. But only because his words somehow made me aware that something was missing. Something that had been missing for a while, maybe for always, but I never knew what it was. It made me discouraged and confused, and I could feel my eyes welling up. I started to doubt what he was saying, but the desire to understand it far outweighed the uncertainty. Just the thought of being filled with water that would never leave, of refreshment that would never end, to never have to be in this dry state or feel this emptiness. Before I knew it, I was begging him to please give me this water so that I would not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water. But then he told me to go and call my husband, to get him to come here. It was like a spear to my stomach, reminding me that I was not even worthy to receive such a gift. Why would I even think I could be? He didn't know who I was. He didn't know my past. I could feel the hot desert air circling around me, and I just wanted to hide the guilt on my face, so I turned it towards the ground and responded, "I have no husband." And there was silence. But then he broke it and responded, "You are right in saying you have no husband." Well, immediately my head came back up and I looked at him with shock. He continued, "For you have had 5 husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true." I just stood there stunned. How did he know? Did somebody warn him about me? Was I that talked about? Or was it just that obvious? But then I thought, well, wait, he's still speaking with me, even though he knows all these things about me. And my mind carried me back to the stories that I had heard when I was young, about the prophets of old and how at the temple they were able to hear from Yahweh, who saw all things. This man clearly had something to that effect, but the prophets of old spoke words over their own people. What was his business with me? I then lifted up my gaze towards the mountain, to where the old temple ruins were, and I questioned him. "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet, but our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship. And I don't think it will surprise you to hear that he smiled at this comment, but not in a way that made me feel inferior, as if I had said something foolish, but rather in a way that assured me that he understood where I was coming from. And then he said to me, 'Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know. For salvation is from the Jews.'" As he paused, I sat down on the edge of the well, needing to let this all sink in. If what he was saying was true, and it doesn't matter where one worships, but rather what one knows, then what did they know or have that we didn't? He continued, "For the hour is coming, and is now here, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." This was all a bit overwhelming for me, but oddly enough, I was still enthralled by his words. Listening to him gave me energy, a hunger that only begged for more. Even if it didn't make sense, just sitting here with him, hearing him speak about the Father in that way, I actually wanted to understand. But it was like there was a barrier that I couldn't cross. I was looking, but I wasn't seeing. Do we not gain salvation by worshiping in the temple? How does it come from the Jews? And what was this truth that he spoke of? Worshipping a God who is above us in spirit didn't make sense. If God is spirit, how can we worship him if that spirit is not with us? I remembered my mother teaching me that truth would come when the great teacher would come, the great prophet, he who would make everything clear. And so I told this man, "I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ, and when he comes, he will make everything clear." And then he said to me, "I who speak to you am he." It was him. It was actually him. He was here. You would think that there would be doubt, but there wasn't. I just knew that what he was saying was true. This was truth. Somehow I was experiencing truth. I wasn't searching for it or having to fight for it. It was here, right here in front of me, in the form of a man. And somehow within seconds, suddenly all the pieces fell into place. And I burst into tears, but they were tears of joy. I immediately had a desire to go and tell the others, to share this news with everyone. And as I looked back towards the village, and then back at him, he smiled in understanding, and gave me a nod to go. So I began running back towards the village, nearly crashing into some men who had been standing at a distance, perhaps companions of this man at the well. They were probably wondering what he was doing, speaking with me. However, that was no longer of importance. I kept running, even though realistically my body didn't possess the energy. But there was a new spring of life in me that put strength in my legs. And as I ran, my reputation never even played a factor. I didn't care what people would think or if they would believe me. I just knew I had to tell them. I got to the center of the village and began shouting for the people's attention, and surprisingly, everyone turned their eyes towards me, most likely because it was a voice they'd never heard, but they also listened as I shared my experience. Their eyes widened as I spoke about the man who told me all that I had ever done, and I asked them, could this be the Christ? By this point, a huge crowd had gathered around, wondering what all the commotion was about, and I encouraged everyone to come back with me to the well and to see for themselves. So I led the people back to where this man and his companions were now conversing. And as we approached the well, he stood up to greet us, and the leaders of Samaria began asking him questions. They then invited him, a Jew, to come back to the village with us and eat with us and stay with us. And he agreed. People from all over Samaria heard of his arrival, and the meeting house was packed to the walls that evening with hungry individuals wanting to hear this man speak. He taught all of us, men, women, children, whoever would listen, about who he was and how the scriptures spoke of him. And many more came to believe him because of his words. He spoke of the world being dead in sin, but that he had come to heal, to restore, and to forgive, and there were times where I felt like he was speaking right to me. My eyes were never dry the entire evening. I came so that you may have life, he said, that you may have it to the full. And I really believed it. Because for the first time, I felt like I had freedom to start over. And I knew that it wasn't just a feeling, because my reputation seemed to have been forgotten by everyone else, too. People came up to me, to speak with me, to tell me that it was no longer just my testimony that allowed them to believe. They said, "Now that we have heard him for ourselves, we know that this is indeed the Savior of the world." He stayed with us for 2 days, and it was often hard for me to grasp some of his teachings. Like when he described the Spirit of God and how it could dwell within us. I didn't fully understand what he was saying, but I still found peace through his words. In a way, it was kind of like reaping in a field during a harvest. You have to put in a little effort to attain the grain. But once you have it, you have a food that nourishes not just you, but whomever you share it with as well. And the more he spoke and healed those who heard him, the more I saw a need for us to sow what we had now reaped. And it is he who I now think about when I experience times of silence. Because even if I'm alone, There's always a sense of understanding, a trust that someone else knows how I feel. I remember how simply being with him gave me peace, made me want to tell others about him, to share my story and explain how they too could be forgiven, could be washed clean, could be set free, and how they too could be filled with living water.